Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, September 6, 2018. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and conservative cultural criticism from a conservative cultural perspective. Join us at CommentaryMagazine.com. We give you a few free reads. We ask you to subscribe, $99 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including me speaking English coherently. And our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. Very exciting news. October 8th this year, we do our 9th annual roast. We are roasting Senator Joe Lieberman. If you have any interest in joining us, it's $750 a ticket. We will give you all the information. It's in New York, October 8th. You can email theroast@commentarymagazine.com for more information. We will have Senator Lindsey Graham. We will have Meghan McCain. We will have Ambassador Ron Dermer, and a lot of other fun teasing, needling, and amusing anecdotes and videos and music dedicated to making gentle and delightful fun of Joe Lieberman, one of the great men of our time. TheRoast@CommentaryMagazine.com. With me, as always, on this podcast, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Noah Rothman, our associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And senior writer Sourabh Amari. Hi.
Hi, John.
Okay, guys. America basically has sprung a leak. We've gone off the rails. The wheels have come off the bus. The plane is crashing.
Spiraling.
They were spiraling out of control. Every cliche you can think of. Abe, just rehearse for us just the last 36 hours.
I'll do my best. I'm sure I'll miss things. So we have the revelations from Bob Woodward's book about the Trump administration. We can rehearse in detail the specific revelations, but generally speaking, there are credible reports of Trump calling members of his administration mentally retarded, various people in the administration describing the president as an idiot, hiding documents from him so that certain policies and orders don't get carried out. This is something that's already become a barely noticed detail in all the hysterics of the week. Conspiracy theorist Alex Jones harassing Marco Rubio on Capitol Hill, laying his hands on him, calling him names.
And then Rubio basically threatening to be,
yes,
to say, I'll take care of you myself.
Yes,
yeah,
that's right. And then, of course, we have the Brett Kavanaugh hearings and all the theatrics from the costumed protesters to U.S. senators declaring the actual hearings illegitimate. We have yesterday's bombshell anonymous op-ed in the New York Times, in which someone from within a supposed senior administration official claiming to be working from the inside of the administration to thwart Trump's worst instincts
that he and his friends are all working to save America from the president that they serve.
Right. And then we have Trump's response to the op-ed, in which he has asked the New York Times to turn over the op-ed writer to the government. He claimed that the Times wouldn't exist without him, the failing New York Times, and so
treason.
On and so forth. Yes. And
treason, then, exclamation point.
Right, right. And then this
and
morning.
That doesn't, yes, and then this morning.
We have Cory Booker, who has threatened and then, in fact, released a confidential memo saying about Kavanaugh, saying that that Booker himself understands the ramifications for doing this, very possibly mean his ouster from the Senate, and he is willing to endure this. This is his Spartacus moment. And
he said, so, I've never come closer to saying I am Spartacus than now, which is, by the way, if I could just say, because I need to point certain historical facts out, that the author of the book of Spartacus and the screenplay to Spartacus, the movie, both Howard Fast and Dalton Trumbo, both Stalinists. So I just wanted to point that Cory Booker has now cited the line of dialogue written by two Stalinists to support his supposedly heroic act of releasing a memo, I believe, that says Brett Kavanaugh opposed a racial set aside in the government, which hardly seems disqualifying to me.
You're not running for president in 2020 in the
Senator
Democratic
Sheldon
primary.
Whitehouse saying that because he views the hearing that is taking place for the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh to be illegitimate, he doesn't have to follow any of the rules. Of course, the sideshow in the Senate hearing where they just interrupted everybody mm-hmm. and said whatever they said, Kamala Harris spending 20 minutes insinuating weirdly that Kavanaugh had a strange conversation. Did he have a conversation with a lawyer at the firm of Kazowitz, Benson, and Torres?
Don't forget.
By the way, Mark Kazowitz is the executive chairman of the Lieberman Roast. Dan Benson, other name partner, is the chairman of Commentary's board. My nephew, Jake Abrams, is a lawyer at Kazowitz Benson. I love them. I love them all. They're great. And as far as I'm concerned, Brett Kavanaugh can talk to any, and Joe Lieberman of counsel to Kazowitz, right. Benson, and Torres. So maybe the conversation that he had with someone at Kazowitz, Benson, was with Joe Lieberman, which would be criminal. It would be terrible if Brett Kavanaugh had a conversation with a former senator from Connecticut and Democratic vice presidential nominee. That was some weird stuff. And then, of course, the hand gesture.
Right, right. So I've forgotten her name.
Zina Bash.
Right, was an associate of Kavanaugh's, was sitting behind him, accused of flashing a white power sign in the form of the OK sign with her hand.
Now, we need to explain how they saw that, because there's a video, and she's sitting behind him, and somehow some lunatic figures out how to zoom in on her in the video behind and sees
and she's
that
a U.S.
fingers.
Attorney, by the way, right?
Is she assistant U.S. attorney?
Assistant U.S. attorney. I think so. Yeah.
Anyway, but she's sitting with her hands on her lap and her fingers are in some configuration, and so suddenly the lunatic resistance world on Twitter announces that she is making a secret white power sign. Mm-hmm.
Now it turns out she was born in Mexico and her father's
no,
Jewish.
Her mother is Mexican. Her father is, she's the granddaughter of Holocaust survivors, and her mother is Mexican, which doesn't mean.
She was born in Mexico as well.
Oh, she was? Yes. Well, then she can't be president.
This is reminiscent of the 2012 dog whistle craze, in which only people who were opposed to Republicans were finally attuned to the racism that they were supposedly trying to broadcast to their fellows. Things like Gulf, Apartment, Constitution, and Chicago were in invocations to be of the full white supremacist you really wanted to be. The left has been accusing people whose index and thumbs meet in any kind of configuration of secretly projecting white supremacist symbols for some time now.
Right, but in terms of how America is coming off the rails, let's just make this. So here we have a public official, public servant. No, her husband is a U.S. attorney. Longtime associate of Kavanaugh's, I think a clerk of Kavanaugh's. Nobody knows who she is. She's basically someone who works in the public interest, whatever. Suddenly becoming a major American celebrity in 5 minutes because Seth Abramson and his mob of idiot jerks start yelling about how, oh my God, there's someone behind Brett Kavanaugh making an okay sign. Like, you know, if we had standard, you know, if defamation, you know, she should sue everybody for defamation. Like, this is among the most outrageous and irresponsible, unfair, mean, horrible, and this is, talk about the depersonalization of your enemy. So, like, they don't even know what she, for all we know, she votes Democrat, you know, and she's there because she was Kavanaugh's clerk. You know, I know somebody who is a clerk to Michael Mukasey and, you know, David Souter, and, you know, is a Democrat, and now he's a judge, and, you know, this does happen, but it's okay because it's just open season on everybody at all times ever.
It's like just this weird, you know, sometimes I say this because I'm a person of weird nervous tics and hand movements, you know, where I have these obsessions with holding my hands symmetrically when I'm sitting and doing the perfect symmetrical, you know, and that's what she was doing. She's just sort of, you know, you rest your hand.
You racist. The old symmetrical hand.
I don't even know why we have to indulge in the. I do that sometimes too. Like, who knows what she was doing? For all we know, she has arthritis. You know, and that relieves some pressure on her knuckles. Like, the who knows? It's totally deranged. But I mean, I think what we have here, and I think this is what we want to talk about today, really, is you wanted to see it burn. We're seeing it burn. You know, that line from The Dark Knight, some people just want to see the world burn. So there's a large number of people in this country, or a large part of the political class in America, who wanted to see it burn, right? They didn't want conventional Republican politicians. They wanted Trump. They didn't want proper senatorial procedure. They wanted the filibuster nuked. And now the Senate is basically functioning as effectively as a like the House, as Noah would say, that is just a simple majority rule, leading these senators in the minority to turn into kind of goons to make the case against the lifetime appointment of Brett
Well,
Kavanaugh.
If I can actually toot our own horns a little bit, I've been writing about this for some time. We have a fantastic piece.
Okay,
we have a fantastic piece, and I think it was 2 months ago in the magazine from Yuval Levin, about how Congress is essentially abdicating its responsibility. It's ceding its power to competing power centers, which would have vexed the founders incredibly, ceding its authority to the courts, ceding its authority to the executive. And now the Senate is ceding its authority to the will of the mob, which was something that was, again, a lot of these checks were not built into the Constitution, but were part of the founders' design for these chambers. And as the Senate has decided to sort of pare back the minority's privileges, especially with the filibuster, most notably, and the legislative aspect of the filibuster is just the next to go, and it's only a matter of time. And when it does, the Senate will behave as a simple majority institution, which is as the House already does, and then its members will behave like politicized crazy people because they will be posturing and pandering and not effective institutionalists navigating a really thorny and complex labyrinthian design to keep people from behaving like crazy members of the House.
So we should talk about this because, you know, the design of one of the many geniuses of the system of the Constitution was that you had a body that was basically supposed to serve as a model of direct election, right? That's the House, right? Simple majority rule, majority domination, district by district, large numbers of people. And then you had the Senate, which wasn't even an elected body until 1913, which was deliberately anti-majoritarian, right? Two senators from every state, no matter what the population number was. And the Senate developed all these elaborate rules of procedure in order to make sure that it frustrated.
Very much in the Roman spirit of the idea of the Senate, which is the idea that there are people who are in some sense accountable, but not directly vulnerable to the mob.
Right. So in 1913, a constitutional amendment was passed. The Senate became
not a good idea.
So 100 years later, Harry Reid did us the immense favor of destroying of starting to take a cleaver to the filibuster. The genius of the filibuster rule and the making it necessary for there to be a supermajority to close debate in the Senate was precisely to frustrate legislative ambitions or even executive ambitions, like to make all this harder because you don't want, you know, mob rule.
Because when you eventually had to vote to confirm a president's cabinet post or nominee to the Supreme Court, you didn't want on the record yourself railing and sounding like an insane person because it would make your vote look hypocritical.
Yeah. So, right. So,
but now nobody has any problem with that because you don't have to vote for the president and eventually you won't have to be a supermajority for cabinet nominations or for legislation. It's all going out the window.
And if, as Yuval argued in his very wise essay a couple of months ago in Commentary, if now the ambition of the senator or member of Congress is to be a TV, radio celebrity, then the crazier you act, the more Spartacus right. scenes you pull off, the, right. the better you're doing.
Okay, but, if you're Cory Booker, let's just take Cory Booker as an example. Cory Booker,
it's not crazy, by the way. It's scene chewing. It's cloying. It's not very calculated.
Yeah, it's
cynical. It's dramatic.
I think it's right. cynical.
It's theatrical. It's like Tom Cruise in A Few Good Men. People have seen this clip a million times. You know where he goes, "You can't hide. I want the truth." You know. If you remember the actual dramaturgy of the scene, it was by design that he lost it because he wanted to push Jack Nicholson's buttons. Cruise wasn't overacting. The character Cruise was playing was overacting. This is exactly what Cory Booker and these people are doing when they do this. You know, the centers who are having these tantrums, they are doing it. It's emotive. It's, you know, false, and its purpose is to push not only our buttons to get us to say, "Oh, you're just a bunch of morons," but to push the buttons of the resistance people who go, "Oh, finally, we have a hero who is willing to stand up and fight for power." You know,
which like is that. The exact mirror image of what Donald Trump managed to pull off in 2016. His projects, his policy recommendations were unfeasible, and that is why they were attractive. They communicated to his voters the desperation that they felt. It didn't matter that there was their extremism that was attractive.
Well, and let's talk about that in relation to the thing that he said last night about the anonymous op-ed, which I think all of us have very critical feelings about. I think about the substance and the act that is represented by the anonymous op-ed. The president of the United States is demanding that the New York Times turn over someone to the authorities. Now, first of all, that's exactly emotive nonsense. Like, what is that? Who you will turn them over to the authorities immediately? Like,
well,
what
see, is, I think what I if, think everyone
who's the authority?
What's the crime?
Like I said on Twitter last night, we talked about like Hebrew National. They're the higher authority. Like the sports of the what authority?
I feel like everyone
the marshal
is
of
acting?
The set the marshal of the Supreme Court. Who's the authority who's supposed to be turned over to?
I think everyone is acting. Honestly, more and more for Twitter. In other words, Trump is doing what the Twitter crowd expects him to produce, which is that tweet. And Booker is producing a 3-minute piece of video that is just perfectly timed for the amount of attention people have.
Here's the difference, though.
Twitter.
Donald Trump has always been this way. Cory Booker was not. Cory
right.
Booker has
That's
adopted this persona.
Right. That's a good point.
We should talk about this because the journey of Cory Booker mirrors the journey in some sense of George W. Bush's America to Trump's America. So Cory Booker in the early 2000s was a Harvard scholar guy with political ambitions in New Jersey and was known to everybody. It was not clear. He had some very conservative instincts, supporter of school choice, all kinds of stuff. Very good friends with a bunch of conservatives in New Jersey who wanted him to become a Republican.
And a real corruption buster. He had an actual
Well, that's
record.
Later. So then he becomes a politician, right? He becomes education, the head of education in New Jersey, I think.
I don't recall. Before
anyway, but eventually he becomes the mayor of Newark. And his thing in Newark was, A, he busted corruption. He tried to
Which
help.
Isn't hard for anybody who proceeds sharp jam.
He tried to help the schools. He was a reformist mayor, quite non-ideological, and sort of representing some new possible synthesis, a kind of Obama type, getting his hands dirty with actual, you know. And then there was all the funny stuff where he would like go and help put out a fire, you know, or like save someone from a car, change somebody's
That's very
tire.
LaGuardia.
Yeah,
I mean, he's
right.
kind of a hands-on
right.
mayor.
So then he becomes a senator, and he gets into the Senate. He's a very, you know, he's sort of, and so as the Obama era progresses, and then as Trump comes on, he becomes more and more and more and more populist. Clearly thinking that he is somebody with a main chance. He's young, he's African American. The Democratic Party would be well advised, I think everybody understands, to nominate an African American in 2020 in order to generate the kind of turnout that can help neutralize the, you know, white working class turnout that Trump might be able to generate, that Hillary was not able to generate. And he and Kamala Harris and Deval Patrick, the former mayor of former governor of Massachusetts, seem to be the three people who are best fit this bill in contemporary politics. And what is it that he realizes he has to do? He realizes he has to go crazy. He has to become a crazy person. Like, and he doesn't do it well. He doesn't come across like he comes across like a studious, you know, a student who is learning how to be a crazy person by watching crazy people and maybe listening to an episode of Chapo Trap House, and then sort of
his,
like
his online persona and his theatrical persona in the well of the Senate is not just angry though and fixated and ideological. It's also, as you said earlier, emotive and dramatic, and he's very. He adopts this sort of.
He cried, didn't he? Didn't he yes. cry on Tuesday?
His saccharine sappiness. He recites poetry. He tweets in verse and stanza. Like, he is extremely theatrical, and that's I don't think only that's, you know, entirely his real persona, but it's partly him, because this moment calls more for anger than it does that kind of theatricality and sappiness. I'm not exactly sure what he's getting at there, but there's something that he thinks calls for, like, love and pure devotion to, you know, country and cause and what have you, not just pure anger.
Anyway, so I just think he's an interesting example, because what you're trying to do is you maintain your standing as a sort of sane, middle of the road, relatively middle of the road Democrat, while doing what you can in performative terms to reach out to the Sanders left and the anti-Trump resistance left, while holding your place.
I admired him in 08, 09 when he was mayor. I thought he was, and really what stood out was that sort of centrism about him. And then as he came into the Senate, I remember he was not, at least initially, lockstep with the Obama administration. He was more pro-Israel. Shmuley Boteach, the famous rabbi, I think they co-authored op-eds together, yeah. And he championed him in various ways.
Yeah.
I think, and then the shift really happened, I think, toward the end of the Obama administration when he, I mean, I think a lot of pro-Israel people saw as this betrayal yeah. on the Iran deal.
Right.
And yeah. then with the yeah. Trump administration, he became another character.
Well, and he was also playing for the Veep slot with Hillary, which remains the fact that she did not pick him. Remains one of the many signs of why what an absolutely horrible politician she was, because she picked somebody who literally gained her absolutely nothing. And, you know, whereas maybe, you know, she had gone a little riskier, because I guess he's risky because he's not married or something, you know. But I think what you see there, again, is this question about a larger question about America's institutions and whether what we're seeing here. And I think you could argue that the major institutional collapse, that the series of institutional collapses in Washington that really started accelerating, could be traced back to the Harry Reid's blowing up of the filibuster on judicial nominations in 2013. Because it was around then also that Obama went with that rhetoric about how we can't wait, and I can't wait for the fact that the Republicans won't do what I want them to, so... We're gonna do everything by executive order. We're gonna incept the DREAM Act, you know, by
that's
executive.
That's
order.
The institutional precedent. But I think the excuse now in the Trump age is that because Trump is president, by any means necessary. Right.
I would go back a little further to the legislative and parliamentary tricks that were used to pass Obamacare. And I think
Demon pass,
reconciliation, right. Christmas Eve, all that stuff.
But the oddity of that was, remember that Obamacare, unlike all of this now, Obamacare was, Democrats had 59 votes right. in the Senate and had, I don't know, a 50-seat majority in the House. Like, there were even arguments in a funny way for that, because Democrats had so much command of the higher ground of American politics and the power centers of American politics that it wasn't that much of an argument to say if they were going to pull some maneuvers that didn't reflect, you know, even though Obamacare was unpopular in polling, it reflected a political reality. It wasn't like Obama trying to create the Dream Act from the White House, right, you know. Yeah.
There's something I also, I think there's an important distinction between parliamentary tricks and exploiting loopholes and doing what Cory Booker has now done, which is to say, I'm going to act, I'm going to subvert the rules. I'm going to consciously break the rules and suffer the consequences.
He said he called it, knowing that he would not suffer any consequences.
Well, we don't know that yet, but he called it.
Wait, he's going to be expelled from the Senate?
I don't know. He calls it civil disobedience, right? Now, civil disobedience is that what is the classic definition? You disobey a law you believe to be unjust, right? So does Cory Booker believe that
Senate confidentiality
rules? That confidentiality rules that govern the United States government and the private exchanges between its officials that do not rise to the level of legal, you know, something that requires, you know, a legal intervention, that those laws are illegitimate?
They clearly don't, because all of yesterday we spent litigating the prospect that Senate confidentiality rules were violated in Mr. Senator Leahy's case.
That's right. Leahy kept saying, did you read
all day long
my stolen document?
By the way, John, you were saying this in the pre-show, and I agree, too, that, I mean, I think Trump, whatever you think of him, is the president that's been least afforded that courtesy, that the idea built into our constitutional vision mentioned by, you know, repeatedly in the Federalist, that there's a need for executive branch officials to be able to speak frankly, to deliberate without basically their deliberations being made public. And, you know, with this guy who says, you know, we take away papers from him, or the Woodward bit where he said, you know, he mused about assassinating Assad, you know, and that's supposed to alarm us. But, you know, the guy, it was deliberating. That's you know, I can see George W. Bush throwing something out. Right. But it's like, no, he's not normal. So anything he says should immediately make it into the pages of the New York Times. It's not fair.
So let's rehearse this, because the Woodward book, I want to say, I believe every anecdote in the Woodward. The denials of everybody seem
very
fair.
No, I do too.
Okay.
With the caveat that there's obviously context that's missing from
always, but Woodward's books always have. That's one. They're written in this very peculiar way. If you've read them, they don't really have structure. They don't have. They sort of end in the middle, practically in the middle of a sentence. They don't add up. There's no much analysis. It's like a sort of emptying of a notebook. It's very strange. But, I mean, I don't think that any of the denials are believable here. You know, Mattis's denial or Pompeo's denial, whatever. But I do think that this anecdote is worth talking about. So they're having some meeting about Syria. And Trump says, why don't we just effing kill the guy, right? Okay, so they don't kill him, because Mattis says to him, well, that's not the policy that we're pursuing here, and I'm not sure it would help. And in any case, okay, so he didn't issue an order. Mm-hmm. There was no document from the president to James Mattis saying, I hereby authorize the assassination
of
Bashar al-Assad.
I wish there were. But this has been used by some to say, to support the notion in this op-ed that there is this some sort of a soft coup going on, and that the president issues these orders and then the people around him just ignore them. And this has been used to dovetail with this Mattis anecdote. We all lived through this. We have very detailed reports about the options that were presented to the president, the assets that were in place or needed to be in place at the time of these strikes, the options that he chose, the effect that they would have. I mean, this is not something that came out of the blue. So in order for you to believe that there was some sort of a coup going on here, you have to really selectively remember
but
events.
This is a broader, so here's what we don't know. So we know that from the Woodward book that Gary Cohn, who was the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, purloined some papers out of Trump's inbox so that he would not be permitted to sign them. Okay, we don't know what the papers were, but we can presume that they either had something to do with trade,
have to withdraw,
right? Yeah. Or for all one knows, they have something to do with immigration in Mexico and Stephen Miller and stuff like that. Okay, now it's only a coup if Trump signs the papers and then the order, and then the papers are thrown in the wastebasket, right? In other words, the coup only happens if orders are being given that are literally, you know, technically have been issued that are not carried out. But I don't know what to call it when you are presiding over administration in which the senior people only feel that the country will be safe if they cannot trust that if you were given option A or option B, that the choice that you make won't be incredibly damaging to the country. Now, I would say if you really...
steady state, John.
That's the steady state. That's the term from the op-ed. So it's not really a coup because in none of these cases, we have historical evidence dating back decades, and any workplaces like this where the boss, you're in a room and the boss says, why don't we, you know, stop, the head of Burger King, you say, why don't we stop selling Whoppers? I don't like them anymore. I had one the other day and it really didn't taste good, right? And they're like, well, he's had a few too many today, or, you know, he had a fight with his wife or whatever. And so you like, you just don't do anything and then see if he brings it up again tomorrow or says we really need to do a study and see if we need to get rid of the Whopper, right? So this is standard procedure in all workplaces.
That.
And you have to be able to, yeah, like sit around and excuse me for saying this, bullshit. If you're the president, you also get to ruminate and bullshit, even if you're Donald Trump and you're a crazy person, or you're George W. Bush, or you're Barack, you're whoever you are. And it is true that when you know, it's like the sausage factory. Nobody wants to see how the sausage is made, or people really do want to see how the sausage is made because it's really intriguing and thrilling. But you know, the back room conversations of presidents and people like that are not all that dissimilar from the backroom conversations, including Trump.
The op-ed has infuriated people. And in my view, this is this is going to be controversial, but I think it's probably wise.
Controversial.
Wise that it was anonymously written, because we are talking about the ideas expressed and not the individual's identity or his politics or anything like that, which would be used to discredit those ideas. And those ideas, as were conveyed, are boilerplate, status quo anti-republicanism. Deregulation, tax cuts, projecting and defending democracy, and containing America's adversaries abroad. That's the sort of thing that didn't used to annoy people until the President of the United States stopped doing all those things. So what we have here is no confession of any action being taken, only the active effort to advise the President to do courses of actions that align with that boilerplate status quo anti-republicanism. I haven't heard anybody say anything about what was done. No action that was not taken.
Well, the op-ed mentions, specifically says, Trump did not want to go hard on Russia, and the steady state prevailed. But that goes to your point, which is
that
he was talked into it.
Precisely. And he's now
he
on the trail
off on
taking credit for this action.
First of all, I solidly disagree. I think the op-ed was an irresponsible act on its own terms and look at it from the outside. And the idea of anonymity is deeply problematic. I don't know. I was on the WJF page. John, you worked in, we never did anonymous op-eds. I remember one instance where I had gotten some Syrian dissident or something. This was early in the stages of the Civil War, to write something. And we came very close. But in the end, he insisted on anonymity, and the piece was spiked because of that. Because people need to be able to judge,
right,
you know, who is the person saying this, and the reader can't know. When you say senior administration official, that could be Pence, or it could be some nobody, you know, toiling away at the, you know, in the speech shop of the National Security Council, who we've never heard of, and so we don't know how much access he really has, how much of the things he says are firsthand, and how much of them are third and fourth hand. So
can I just interrupt, because there was this fantastic, I sort of have an idea, I here's somebody anonymous, I think I sort of have an idea who it is and I'm not going to say, but BuzzFeed published this hilarious parody last night of the anonymous piece that I think is worth reading here, which is it's the New York Times opinion section is facing a challenge unlike any faced by a modern American newspaper. It's not just the Sarah John controversy or Quinn Norton's firing or Brett Stevens' problems with college leftists or Barry Weiss's problems with college leftists or Julius Shulevitz's problems with college leftists or David Brooks's problems with college leftists or Frank Rudy's problems with colleges. There is yet another dilemma that opinion editor James Bennett does not grasp. Many of the senior editors on his own opinion page are working diligently from within to frustrate parts of his agenda and his worst inclinations. I would know. I am one of them. To be clear, ours is not the reflexive gray lady hatred that animates the Twitter mobs. We want this newspaper to succeed. To walk through the turnstiles on 8th Avenue is to feel the solemn silence, the slow contemplation, the unshakable self-confidence that has always defined great American journalism, and to imbibe a sacred duty to the take, the sanctity of an exquisitely mixed Tom Friedman metaphor, which rings like a thunderbolt as it breaks the surface of the bottomless pit. And our opinion section, as it is currently conducted, presents a clear and present danger to the take as we know it. So this is what the New York Times did here, which is that it published a take. Basically, this is just clickbait.
It's an on background.
This piece
quote.
Is pure clickbait. It's created to go make people go, oh my God, oh my God, and it's anonymous. Oh my God, who could it be? People are publishing like, and this is talk about unfair, like people are publishing lists of possible authors of the piece. Like so every single
the manic obsession with the identity of the author is itself justification for the anonymity that was granted to the author.
Well, I suppose, although here's what I would say about the piece. Whatever purpose he thought it served, it didn't serve. This is what I think. The piece has become a reflexive study of itself. So rather than it was unnecessary after the Woodward book for there to be somebody saying people are trying to block Trump's worst inclinations. First of all, as you know, said, we've heard that already for a year and a half.
There's nothing new in this piece. Right? We've been observing right. the stuff that right. he's talking
and
about.
And secondly, the piece that came out from the Woodward book on Tuesday said exactly this in much more explicit detail. So
Wolf's book, the 25th right. Amendment stuff.
That's the anonymity yeah. critique, but the internal critique of the piece on its own terms is if that you believe you're dealing with an quote unquote amoral, authoritarian, enemy of democracy lunatic, then is it, and you're carrying on this supposedly noble project, let's assume that it's noble and good, isn't it a dumb thing to tell him that there is such a project to thwart his aims?
Yes.
Wouldn't he then say, you know what? Round up every speechwriter, the NSA goes through all their emails, blah 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 yeah. blah, and then discover and the
absolutely no good comes from this.
It only makes him more paranoid. It makes him more less inclined to listen to reason. Let's say that would be that. And what does Anonymous get out of this? Nobody knows who Anonymous is. Now you're really not going to know who he is because he knows or she knows, and like three people in the New York Times know. They're not going to release who it is.
I think the name comes out because it's chasing. I think this author wants to come out of it.
And by the way, the army of staunch Trump supporters out there are now saying, and they laughed when we said there was a conspiracy against the president.
Yeah. What now, of course, this doesn't work well. Because he's a political appointee or she's a political appointee. That's why the piece says it's not the deep state. It's the dead state. But that's incredibly destructive.
The piece doesn't allege anything was done.
That's the external critique of it, is that you are in the position you are because Donald Trump, like him or not, won an election. Otherwise, you would be toiling away anonymously. Well, you're still toiling away anonymously, but even more anonymously at some law firm or in some newspaper editorial page, or a magazine. I don't know. I didn't want to narrow down. And you would be a nobody. So it's a pretty D-less, pardon my French, thing to do that. Like if you want to say that, resign, come out, be Spartacus, and resign
is what Democrats are saying. They're saying anybody of conscience would leave this president with only the absolute dregs right. Washington has to offer,
yeah.
and then they would be really frustrated by that condition.
But
there's
a middle option. There's one. Where
no,
you
the middle option is you don't publish the piece. Right, that's the middle option.
You just quietly do your thing.
Because again, I don't know what Anonymous got out of the piece. That's the point.
I'm hesitant to say that this is going to be a disaster for us. Acknowledge the two-track presidency is dangerous. Acknowledging the facts on the ground as they have been existing for 18 months and we've all observed them is less dangerous.
Any take that
is predicated on Donald Trump becoming an extremely engaged executive, I'm very dubious of.
No, but you could look. Do you want him more paranoid? I mean, that
can this he be is, more if, paranoid? No, but
if you're anonymous, do you want him more paranoid about you? That's why I don't understand the purpose of the piece.
If your if aim you out of this cra- is if to you get ever MSNBC. Worked for a crazy
person, I frankly don't understand the point of the piece either. But okay. I don't. I'm, I don't for, want aside us to, from me, to go to boiling
work,
point.
Okay, you all work for me. So aside from me, an obvious crazy person, have you ever worked for a crazy person or in an organization run by a crazy person? Because I have. I worked at the Washington Times, which was literally run by a crazy person, owned by a crazy person who thought he was the Messiah. And I've worked at other places and worked for people who worked for that guy who thought he was a Messiah. And when you get into senior management, all sorts of weird problems start manifesting themselves about your responsibility to the people who work for you. And what do you do about this? And what? How do you protect them from the crazy person at the top? And what? And if you're going to stay, what is it that you're supposed to do to make sure that they are not influenced or affected by the craziness or whatever? And it's very complicated. It is a complicated thing that you are obliged in. And this, and that's just like some, that was just some toy newspaper. I mean, this is the, you know, the presidency of the executive branch of the United States. And to be so cavalier about it for so little result, what, for a 700-word piece that says, don't worry, we're protecting free minds and free markets?
I have a pretty a pretty basic, I mean, a cynical sense of what the guy gets out of it, which is a guy or a girl, who knows, but I've heard the New York Times editors refer to him as he, but absolution among your friends for joining the administration.
You still have to go public for them to give you absolution.
I think that that's coming. I don't think you can do this without knowing that eventually your identity is coming.
You know, you're on MSNBC.
They don't seem to like him either.
I'm 100% on board with that. That's what I think is happening.
The MAGA people don't like him. People like us don't like him.
Oh, are you kidding me?
And the liberals don't like him.
The resistance bucks will flow. The second this person's identity is revealed.
I'm skeptical. Because the line is, whatever that person did, he's supporting the policies of the Trump administration. Remember, we draw a distinction between the policies and the bad behavior, right? The left doesn't. They think it's all
the
same.
The only thing that is going to matter is how mad Donald Trump is at this person.
Yeah, I was about to say, I mean, and this is scary in and of itself. Whoever it is might be, if their plan was to come out, and reveal themselves at some point to get the windfall. I think they may be hesitant now.
I would be.
Yeah, I
would. I doubt. Now. Look, people like people have bad judgment. You know, people don't understand how what they want to do, how it might appear to people. I don't
he'll get a fellowship at what is it? Stand Up America.
He's going to get a book deal. And it's going to be a big book deal.
That might happen.
The resistance it's inside possible. And right.
Going to get
itself.
An advance, a six-figure advance, and not work on K Street.
Yeah, but a book deal could be written by anonymous. The book could be written by anonymous.
But see, now we've hit.
But then how do we know? Of course, you know the famous thing where the anonymous book about the evil Iraq War was written by a crazy person. You remember this? Michael, what was his name? Michael Scheuer, the guy who is...
Vaguely, yeah.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Isn't he now...
No, he's like a... He's
commentator.
He wrote a book called Imperial Hubris about, you know, how it was terrible, that CIA official, how we went into the, Iraq War. And then basically he has become this, like, vile anti-Israel, you know, calling for the assassinations of Obama and Trump. And vile anti-Semitism. And this book was like, well, I had to be anonymous because, you know, I was inside the CIA writing about the blah, blah, blah. So, it's not necessarily the best career move or not a sign of necessarily to do stuff like that, or at least someone you should trust because they're willing to be so craven. Yeah, so come out.
There's some truth to those who are really frustrated by this op-ed on all sides of the spectrum. And even those who, while I think the anonymity thing is important, there are those who are like Sarah Sanders who are saying that the creation of these lists now is tarnishing the reputation of some really good people, and you people should be ashamed of yourselves for engaging in this behavior. But they are doing so by adopting language that is damn near Stalinist. traitors and enemies of the people and the cowardly anonymous, you know, what have you, just really obnoxious hyperbole that is unbecoming of a Republican administration.
But the person who wrote the piece said, I am part of the resistance inside the administration.
Yeah, but it's still not treason.
So we should call them treasonous enemies of the people who deserve to be hung by the entrails of their fellow resistance?
No, obviously not. But
that's the performative part. So that's we go back to the whole question of whether or not part of what's going on here with our collapse of all of our institutions right before our eyes, including, by the way, the Supreme Court, whose reputation is not going to survive, you know, these sideshows. Like, the Supreme Court is one of the few institutions that has a positive reputation. And God knows, I know it's some controversy because, of course, the Supreme Court has made some landmark decisions that
Sorab doesn't like.
Sorab in particular doesn't like. But it's one of the unifying things in the country you sort of trust the Supreme Court. Well, after Kavanaugh, you're now going to have, like, basically Democrats saying they don't trust the Supreme Court, right? So the Supreme Court's illegitimate. So that's another institution that's collapsing. But so much of this is performance. Right? So maybe we're not collapsing. What's happening is that the elites are all becoming actors. They're all engaged in performance. And this goes now to a point that I think Sorab made and we should end with, which is, so all this is going on in America. All this is going on in Washington. All this craziness of Booker and Kamala Harris and people screaming and the hand gestures and everything like that. And then there's 330 million people in the United States, and what part of their lives is affected, including, and let's talk about Trump's Twitter feed and Trump's misbehavior and fighting with Colin Kaepernick and all that stuff that makes most people, a lot of people, uncomfortable. But what effect does it have on anybody's actual life? Maybe what we're seeing here is, if politics becomes performative, it by definition becomes less effective and less central to our existences, because not enough people are going to trust that the political system is doing anything to help them, and so they will not do anything to help the political system.
Well, I mean, I have to filter it through my own life, as my point was, look, on the one hand, every institution really seems to be in some sort of slow motion collapse, you know. The Senate, which is supposed to be this repository of wisdom and self-command, has become an S show. And you have guys in condoms wearing condom outfits outside, and inside you have Cory Booker being Spartacus, and, you know, whatever. Then you have the Catholic Church, the bedrock of my life, but the bishops are sniping at each other and da 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 da. You have the presidency, you know, the leader of the free, all of that. Okay, but on my, you know.
The NFL.
That was not
Nike. If you can't trust your sneaker, what can you trust?
Well, look, in national terms, this is all happening in a moment of extraordinary placidness. There is no crisis.
Right.
There is no economic crisis. There's no foreign policy crisis. All the stuff that traditionally sobers you up isn't happening. So we're just inventing our own crisis.
But here's the fear, of course, which is that you end up in a crisis.
But the exception of the Catholic Church, which is a very real crisis.
Right. So you end up in a crisis, and you have institutions that aren't necessarily going to heal themselves quickly enough to be able to respond effectively to it.
Or if you have a real crisis, it'll suddenly, you know, it'll bring out the steel.
Think Donald Trump will rise to the moment? You be a healer and a uniter?
Well, look, I think a lot of us have come to have real questions about the personal comportment and the intellectual gravity and all of that of Rudy Giuliani, right, in the wake of his behavior over the last 3 or 4 or 5 months. And yet there was somebody who we saw, you know, tested and the steel and the metal come out at a really horrible moment. Now, that doesn't necessarily last forever, right? And he's 17 years ago, and people get older, and, you know, they have all sorts of disappointments and all of that. So you don't know what's going to happen. But I don't think that you look at this crew of people and you think that you're really going to turn, you know, boy, the country's going to be in good hands when we get into trouble. And I don't even know if Trump favorable people would necessarily feel that way. In other words, you only need to own the libs as a procedure if you don't have other people to own more importantly than the libs. you know, the comedian Larry Miller said after 9/11, and there were all these, Pat Leahy was going at the, after the Patriot Act, and there was all sorts of stuff, and I was on a panel with him, and he said, you know, here's the thing, like, your house is on fire. You're supposed to all get together to put out the fire, and then you can start arguing over who set the fire and who's responsible for the fire and who should pay for the fire. But when the fire is on, you're supposed to get together and put the fire out.
I've got to say, just this makes me think that in light of the possibility of a coming real crisis, it's another thing that's irresponsible about the op-ed is that it broadcasts to the world that the administration is divided and at war with itself.
Well, that is the problem with the two-track presidency. And anybody who's observed this, especially when it comes to foreign policy, has been very unnerved by the fact that the administration does things that seem to contradict the president of the United States. In fact, the president of the United States, particularly when it comes to the North Korea situation, for example, was arguing with members of his own administration over Twitter over the tactics they were taking in negotiating a deal with North Korea. It was a very much, and nations don't formulate policy based on tweets, but nor can they afford to ignore presidential statements. The stakes are simply too high. And in a crisis environment, the tweets can become a source of miscommunication and miscalculation, and that's a very dangerous thing. So the two-track presidency is a very real problem. Acknowledging that it exists, however, is just simply the facts on the ground. I have no problem with acknowledging the fact that we have an administration that behaves in one way and a president who behaves in another, and it's about time we acknowledge that fact.
But it's broadcasting a weakness.
I mean, I do think...
But whose fault is that?
I do think we're in a position, we are literally now 2 months before the... American people will, in the one of the two massive electoral events that will take place in the next 4 years, will go to the polls and issue some sort of a statement about the political comportment of Donald Trump and the Democrats and our political class. And I don't think that it is surprising that the numbers appear, as we get closer, to be going in the direction other than the Trumpian direction. Not ideologically, and who knows? I mean, if the Kavanaugh stuff continues for a week, and there's, you know, and this kind of lunacy continues for a week, the possibility of unaligned voters saying pox on both your houses and not particularly being enthusiastic about the Democrats is certainly possible. But I do think there's a cumulative effect in over the last month in Trump, by the way, because everything is good, because we're not at war, because we have a strong economy, because we have the lowest job searches new number since 1969,
because of African American unemployment, yeah. It's sort of astonishing, yeah, levels that we haven't, yeah, seen since
He cannot take a victory. He cannot take a proper victory lap. He cannot say, you know, good times are here. He looks for dragons to slay, and they're cultural dragons, right? They're not, you know, it's not that, Thomas Jefferson said, you're not supposed to look abroad for demons to slay or dragons to slay, but he is basically every day looking for something to get
into
a fight.
It's not that he doesn't mention unemployment or the economy.
He mentions it all the time.
He talks about it within the context of himself. He wants,
right,
he wants himself to be the center of the conversation. And guess what? In November, he will be the center of the conversation.
And I don't think it's going to help him. That's part of the point. If you say, look, leave me out of it. Leave my, you know, you like me, you don't like me. You like 4% unemployment. You like growth at over 3%. You like, crime is down, whatever. He has a fundamentally dark, negative perspective on life, on the world, on things, and the solipsistic perspective that you
crippling insecurity
indicate. And it is all about him. And so you get the credit by not taking the credit, but he doesn't believe that to be the case.
Right? By the way, I just noticed, you know what's completely disappeared from the radar? The Cohen and whatever,
the Russia
stuff.
Probe. Yeah.
People were talking to me, because we were talking about his deteriorating job approval ratings. They're kind of down, and I speculated that they had more to do with the McCain remembrances than anything else. And people were saying, no, it's the Cohen stuff. It's all the chaos associated with the Cohen stuff. I couldn't tell you what happened with the Cullen stuff. If right. you asked, like, I don't even remember.
No, but here, here's what I would say. That's what's so extraordinary is that because of Trump's focus and because his focus allows the media to focus on the negative because that's all he's focused on. The Cohen stuff and the Manafort stuff rolling into the McCain funeral, rolling into this whole fight over Woodward and everything like that, just means that he has just uninterrupted bad news at a time when the news isn't bad. It's only bad about him. But he doesn't know any difference between the news being bad about him and the news being good, right? I mean, they could go out and say, you know, we're not at war, we're not at this, we're not at that, we're at 4%, you know, and have a Happy Days Are Here Again commercial. It's Morning in America, right? That was the whole way that Ronald Reagan won in 1984, and Trump will have to win in 2020 that way, except he doesn't know how.
Nor do his people, the burn it all down people, want to hear that message. They don't want to hear that everything is good.
But as I say, that's what's interesting about the owning the libs strategy. So that's the famous comfortably smug owning libs, and it's what the crazier or more repulsive of the Trumpian people, you know, Kurt Schleister and John Nolte and various other people, it's all they want is to drink liberal tears. But yeah, but that's a luxury. It's a luxury to be able to drink liberal tears at a moment, you know, that's a sign, as you say, of placidity. But does anybody in America feel the placidity? Like, you have a president who is stirring up the lake is placid, and he is
cannonballing into it every day.
I'll finish this. So I went to a camp in Canada when I was a kid called White Pine in northern Ontario, and it was on a lake. And the lake, according to the material from Camp White Pine sent to parents, was called Lake Placid. It's like, really? Lake Placid? Isn't there a Lake Placid in New York? Well, it's Canada, so there's another Lake Placid. It's great. But if you looked on a map of Haliburton, Ontario, what you would see is a lake called Lake Hurricane. Okay? So basically, the people who ran the camp changed the name of the lake for their promotional materials because they didn't want parents to think, oh my God, I can't send my kid to Lake Hurricane. There's going to be a hurricane there. Right? So Trump is doing the opposite. He has America's Lake Placid, and he's turning it into Lake Hurricane, and people don't like it.
That's a great column.
Thank you very much. So for Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and Sourabh Amari, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.